Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution with Philip Coppens
and Kathleen McGowan.
Today we are talking about history, which is a very large subject, but specifically we want to focus on the way history is presented to us. The official version of history versus what people call alternative history or revisionist history. And we are also going to delve into some of the ways history is being presented on television.
I'm on a little bit of a rampage today because of some things that are going on over at the History Channel. So we're definitely going to talk about the History Channel and whether or not they should be required to change their name. But we'll get to that coming up in a little while. You know, this issue of history is a huge one for me. I have certainly centered my life and my career around defining history, what I think it is, what it is for me, and then what I want to do about it. And we're going to talk a little bit about how Philip and I both came to this place. We actually sort of met in this field of revisionist history, and that's how we came together. So we're both going to talk a little bit about our personal journeys and where it has taken us, this whole concept of being a revisionist historian. It used to be a dirty word to say something was revisionist history. Oh, they're revisionist historians. And to be honest, I think that it's a noble and honorable thing to be a revisionist historian. I wear that scarlet R with a huge amount of honor and pride because I think it's about time that people stood up and started questioning all these things that, you know, have been spoon-fed to us as a truth for a very, very long time. In my first book, The Expected One, I say in the opening of that book that history is not what happened. History is what was written down. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about who wrote it down, why they wrote it down. And if we can't trust what was written down, then what can we trust? How do we find out what history really is? You know, what is truth? It's one of these enormous questions. And it's different for everybody.
One of the things when I'm asked about a revisionist historian, what does that imply on radio, I quite often give the example that yesterday evening I ate a pizza and I kind of like prepared it all by myself. That's a very historical fact, yet there is not a single person out there in the world who can prove the fact that I ate a pizza yesterday evening. And it's one of these things whereby simply because it's a matter of written record doesn't mean it's the truth or that written records can get to the truth. And that is always a vital message which I always give as an example, which is that truth and written records sometimes do not go together. And specifically, when you are confronted with thousands of years of civilization of Egypt or the Mayans, whereby Christians in both cases burned thousands of books, it's easy to say that we cannot say certain things for sure about ancient Egypt or the Mayan civilization when it's a matter of fact that all of their documents were destroyed. But that doesn't mean there were no documents. In fact, if anything, it means there were documents. We just don't know what they were talking about.
The trick with this is the farther back we go in history, the murkier and more difficult this is to navigate. The farther back you go in history, the more you begin to understand that history was written only by a very specific class of people. History was an expensive thing. Writing was an expensive thing. Ink and paper and education was an expensive thing. Therefore, by default, the people who are recording history are going to come from a specific class and usually a specific perspective. So certainly you have to take into account that all of those things are true. But it takes us back to this idea once again that everyone has a perspective, that history is perspective driven. Now, one of the things that I always say when I give these speeches is take, for example, the idea of putting George Bush in one room and Barack Obama in another room and saying, great, you guys go and write the definitive history of America in the 20th and 21st centuries. Now, the books that you're going to get are going to be entirely different. Okay, suspend disbelief for a minute that George Bush could write that book by himself in the room. But just for a minute, imagine that he could. The point is that what Barack Obama and what George Bush would say about the history of America and where we are as Americans right now in the 21st century are very, very different things, aren't they? You are not going to get the same story from Barack Obama as you're going to get from George Bush, and yet they were both presidents of the United States, and therefore they're both considered very credible witnesses to history. Same thing with Al Gore and Dick Cheney. If you had them write their accounts of their lives in the 20th and 21st centuries and how they affected politics, you're going to show up with very different accounts of what America looked like, what our priorities were, who were the good guys, who were the bad guys, because I'm telling you, the good guys in Dick Cheney's book and the bad guys in Al Gore's book, you know, it's going to be a very interesting correlation with what that would look like. So where does that take us? Imagine 2,000 years from now, only one of those books survives. Well, you better hope that your guy's perspective is the one that survives, because that's going to be looked at as history. So if only George Bush's perspective survives, if only Dick Cheney's perspective survives, the people 2,000 years from now are going to go, well, look, they were president and vice president of the United States. This must be fact. This must be history. And this is what we do when we look at accounts from the early church and biblical times and say, this is definitive. This is how it was because this is the way Josephus wrote it down. We need to look at the perspective of how history was written. And then once we do that, we need to go outside of it. And we need to say, what else is there that allows us to get a look at what history might have been, because we can't trust necessarily everything that was written down.
And I'm just thinking of another story, which is how everybody is confronted with this dilemma when a young child is playing. Imagine your daughter or your son playing with a friend, and the son comes running to you crying and tells you a story. Well, you know, you have to hear the other boy or girl's story to find out where the truth actually is. And it's that balance of two which actually gets us closer to the truth, or in some cases, you know, further away from it. And one of the things which I find of an extremely interesting story is when you were confronted with the story of Oliver Cromwell, as written by Antonia Fraser, which is just an example of how a story of a person can be completely distorted by somebody who at first would not seem to have any real interest in distorting the truth.
Yeah, I think the story about me and Oliver Cromwell is an important one. Certainly it was in my history, because this was the wake-up call for me. I think this was the moment when I realized that history is definitely a matter of perspective. So I want to set this up a little bit by saying that I come from a very proud Irish family. We are very much people who celebrate our Irishness and our culture and our history. And we're also people who very much mourn our history, because the history of the Irish people is in many cases extremely tragic and has been fraught with oppression. And I think that chief amongst these tragedies for the Irish people is certainly what Cromwell did in Ireland in 1649. And for those of you who are not Irish and are not familiar with this, Oliver Cromwell went on a campaign of destruction in Ireland that was absolutely nothing short of genocide. He massacred entire cities. He went into the city of Drogheda and killed every living person. And there were no living people when he was finished. He did the same thing in the city of Wexford. He made examples of the Irish people in this way. There is a street in Drogheda, which is a beautiful, special historical town, not far from Dublin, slightly north of Dublin, about 45 miles or so. Amazing place. I have wonderful friends there who have taught me a lot. There's a street that runs through Drogheda called Scarlet Street, and it's called Scarlet Street because for years, some say centuries, they could not get the blood off the streets. The point that I'm trying to make is for the Irish people, Oliver Cromwell is every bit equivalent to an Adolf Hitler. He went on an absolute genocidal murder spree where he butchered old, young men, women, babies, literally in the streets. People were just hacked to death. This went on for a number of years, actually, in Ireland. 1649 was the real black year when everything went bad. And then after Cromwell, his son sort of took over the action. And another thing that gets lost in history is not only did Cromwell and his descendants butcher the Irish people, but those who survived were sent into slavery. Most people don't realize that more Irish people were sent into slavery in the West Indies in the 17th century, even than African people at that time. So the amount of turmoil and chaos and horror that Oliver Cromwell inflicted upon the Irish people is something that I cannot stress enough. And if you come from an Irish family, particularly a family that's from one of these regions where Cromwell's name is still something that makes people shudder almost 400 years later, you know, you certainly are very, very aware of this. And so you have to imagine what happens to me as an Irish person who believes that Oliver Cromwell is synonymous with evil for what he has done to try to eradicate the Irish and Catholicism. When I go into a bookstore in London and I see a book by Antonia Fraser, who everyone respects as this great British historian, and the book is called Cromwell, Our Chief of Men. And it is this celebration of the life of Oliver Cromwell. And it's, Cromwell's not a bad guy. Cromwell was a lover of music. And it's this biography of him and all of his intelligence and culture. And it's astounding to me that books can be written about Cromwell that celebrate him as this accomplished Lord Protector and completely ignore the fact that he was responsible for the butchery of possibly millions of people. We don't even know what the numbers are. We don't know how many people were destroyed by Oliver Cromwell. And so here I am looking through this book and other books in this English bookstore on Cromwell, and I don't see Drogheda anywhere in the index. I don't see the massacres of Wexford. I don't see anything that even really indicates what Cromwell did in Ireland. And I was disgusted, and I was angry, and I knew that here is Antonia Fraser, and everything she writes is going to be considered gospel. And I know that that account by Antonia Fraser is not true. I know it's not true because what Cromwell did to my people is alive in the streets of Drogheda and Wexford to this day. And that event made me realize that history, the way we look at it, and academia and everything around history is entirely subjective. There is no such thing as historical fact. Historical and fact are mutually exclusive terms. There is only the perspective of the person who is writing it down.
And sometimes it's just a bizarre sequence of events as to how history is written. As much as you were, and we'll come back to this, how you saw how history and what is being written and the facts are quite often different from your time living in Ireland. My waking up call was actually the Kennedy assassination in the early 1990s, and I did quite a bit of research into that because it's a fascinating subject. And one of the biggest tenets of the Kennedy assassination is what is known as the single bullet theory or the magic bullet theory. And the situation is this. We all know Kennedy is killed, assassinated, and in the same car, Governor Connolly, the governor of Texas, is wounded. And very early on, there is a conclusion reached that Lee Harvey Oswald is the only person who has been shooting at these two men, with a lone assassin, i.e. nobody else is involved. And then at one moment in time, they find what is known as a Zapruder film, which is footage which shows the sequence of shots being fired and how these two men react to the individual shots being fired at them. Now, they know that Oswald has been using a Mannlicher Karkana, which is a specific type of weapon, and that for him to be shooting with this weapon, he needs to have at least 2.3 seconds between each individual shot. And for him to accomplish this at 2.3 seconds, he needs to be an expert rifleman. Now, when they start to analyze the Zapruder film, they find that the reaction of Connolly and Kennedy to shots being fired at him is within the 2.3 second range. In fact, there is one shot at 1.9 seconds, which shows to everybody that it's physically impossible that Oswald has shot twice within that sequence. Yet somehow these two men, Connolly and Kennedy, are reacting to a shot. This is a very serious problem for the Warren Commission, who was tasked by Lyndon Johnson to actually come up with how it all worked. So it falls to a junior member of the Warren Commission to try and come up with a fitting solution. That man is Alan Spector, who went on to become a very controversial lawyer. He was on the defensive team for a while of Ira Einhorn, and he then became a congressman or a senator. And more recently, he made headline news once again for being, well, pretty much controversial. So he begins to look at all of this thing, and he also comes up with other problems, which is, for example, that the trajectory of shots, which he has to try and do something with, is really cumbersome, because what seems to have happened is that Kennedy gets hit in the throat. Now, of course, that is a very big problem, because the Kennedy conclusion is that Oswald was behind him shooting from high above, and Kennedy cannot be hit in the throat from up front, but somehow needs to be hit from behind in the back. That is one problem which Spector is confronted with, which he needs to explain. Second problem is that Connolly reacts to a shot somewhere in the thigh, in the wrist, also in his back. And of course, for that problem, we know that Connolly is alive, and we cannot do certain things as easily as we can do with Kennedy, who is basically dead and cannot talk. And then the third shot, which hits Kennedy, is a full-blown shot in the head, which causes a massive explosion. And for that, for those three elements, Spector needs to come up with a solution and mix these ingredients into a scenario which he can explain certain things with. I will not bore you with some of the details of how it all works, but the conclusion is this. Spector says that Oswald shot a bullet which entered Kennedy's back, exited through the body, then somehow traveled upwards, injured Connolly in his body, and then the bullet somehow changed course once again and traveled down once again, lodging in Connolly's wrist. Hence why it's called a magic bullet. Mm-hmm. Now, when Spector comes up with this conclusion, which he calls, you know, it's known as the single bullet theory or the magic bullet theory, because Spector puts it forward as a theory. And he literally says, when he has done this work, he says, I don't think the people are going to believe this year, next year, or 100 years from now. This thing will be challenged today, tomorrow, and forever. This is a man who is in a very difficult situation. He's a junior lawyer. He is surrounded by people like J. Edgar Hoover, by Warren, the Chief Justice, by Alan Dulles, former head of the CIA. All of these people are hanging around him. And he is tasked to distort history for these men, because there is no way, both for historical reasons, for political reasons, for so many reasons, that the truth cannot be made public. But for this, an entire truth is being subjected to a radical reinterpretation. And if you're not convinced by the Zapruder film, let me just tell you that one of the other things is that bullets come, you know, we know the weight of a bullet. And we know the weight of a bullet when it gets fired, and the way, you know, when a bullet kind of like, the weight of a bullet in short. Well, when you add up all the residue of this magic bullet, which allegedly entered three pieces of body, the end result of the bullet, which was found in the wrist as the doctors were removing it from Connolly's wrist, was pretty close to the original bullet weight of when it was shot. When you add all the other pieces of residue from this bullet, from Kennedy's body and from Connolly's body, you actually the conclusion would be that this bullet somehow gained weight after having been shot by Oswald. And it's these kind of things whereby simple mathematics and simple logistics of how much time it takes to fire one bullet after another are completely thrown aside simply because somebody has invested so much money, time, power, and interest into distorting a historical fact that the guy who has to come up with a complete distortion of history says this will never be believed, but guess what? More than 30, more than almost 40 years after the Kennedys, more than 50 years almost, after the Kennedy assassination, the official story still stands that a lone gunman killed John F. Kennedy.
What I think is critical about that story, I mean, we could go on about that story for a really long time because there are so many layers to it, but for the topic that we are on today, what really strikes me about that story is this. The understanding that the facts were intentionally distorted to serve an agenda and have gone down as history. This is not the first time that's happened. Okay, this is not a unique situation. I think the majority of history is exactly magic bullet history. You know, hey, maybe we've just coined a phrase. Maybe it's now all magic bullet history. Because so much of history was written down to serve the agenda of whoever was in power at the time. We certainly see this in church history, don't we? We certainly see this in places where people are declared heretics, where the church needs to excuse their actions in massacring or burning or otherwise invading territories for people who are heretics, infidels, whatever it is they wanted to call them. So, you know, that's I think the crux of this is these things are written down by people who have an agenda to serve their political and economic ambitions. So where does that leave us? You know, that's my question, and that was my question, and that is the question that fueled my journey and the start of my career, and it's still the question that fuels what I do every single day, is if I can't trust what was written down, then what can I trust? An example that I am very fond of that is very personal to me is when my first book, The Expected One, came out, and for those of you who may not be familiar with my book, The Expected One, it is a story about Mary Magdalene, and it is taken from research that I did on Mary Magdalene that comes from the traditions predominantly in the southwest of France. The traditions of Mary Magdalene in France are so strong and so prevalent. And when I first went in search of her, I actually had no preconceived notions. I was not going there believing anything. And I was so overwhelmed by what I discovered that it really took over my life in a way that I had never anticipated. And I have dedicated now, that was 1995, so I've dedicated now about 14, 15 years of my life in, you know, researching Mary Magdalene and her presence throughout Europe. Now, when I wrote The Expected One, I wrote it as fiction because I wanted to tell it as a story because I think that that is a way that people really experience history. So for me, I love historical fiction. I think it's a beautiful vehicle for bringing history to life. But I also take it very, very seriously. I feel as a historical fiction writer that I have a responsibility, and that responsibility is to do as much research as possible and infuse those stories with as much fact as I possibly can. Now, when I wrote The Expected One, it was considered very controversial. It was quite explosive. It got a lot of media attention. And in those media accounts, for example, USA Today did a front page article on this book. What I discovered was every time I was interviewed, whether it was USA Today or Good Morning America or whatever news outlet in the UK, more often than not, there was some academic or scholar was given the last word. Certainly in USA Today, biblical scholars who had written books about the first century were quoted as saying that what I was saying was essentially irresponsible because there was no documentary evidence to back any of this up. There's no documentation that Mary Magdalene was ever in France. And I think actually the final quote was, there is no proof that Mary Magdalene was ever even in France. And as I am fond of saying, there is no proof that Mary Magdalene was in France if you are sitting in an air-conditioned library in North Carolina. If you want to find the proof that Mary Magdalene was in France, you need to get on a plane and spend some time in France. And what I discovered in my work is that if you want to rely on the documentary accounts, if you want to rely on documented evidence as the only thing that tells us about history, vaya con Dios, God bless you, have a great time. That is a very, very narrow black and white study, which I have no interest in. And I don't think it takes us really any further in our understanding as humans about our own history. For me, the real color in history is what is not preserved necessarily in writing. For me, the great passion of my life has been going to the Holy Land, going to the south of France, going to Tuscany, going to all of these places where these legends live, these cultural traditions live, and have lived for 2,000 years, because they live there for a reason. There is a reason that every year in the south of France, the arrival of Mary Magdalene and her entourage is celebrated there and has been for 2,000 years. There's a reason that these things happen. And for me, history then becomes this beautiful collage, this beautiful mosaic of elements. It is taking these beautiful, colorful things that exist, cultural traditions, folklore, legends, etymology, things in the land that tell us about who was there, art, symbols left in art, because as you pointed out, it's so important. So much documentation was destroyed, intentionally destroyed. You know, why is there no proof that Mary Magdalene was in France? Because that proof was destroyed, because a million people died in the Middle Ages to ensure that there would be no proof, because that's what the Albigensian Crusades were about. The only time that Christians created a crusade against other Christians was to wipe out the heresy that Mary Magdalene was in France and started a shadow version of the church that at one time was as big as what was happening in Rome. And until those people were completely massacred. There is a reason that there is no proof, and that's because the proof was destroyed along with the people who held that proof.
Just backtracking slightly to what you're saying about how history is sometimes written by people in hopefully air-conditioned libraries in North Carolina, it's actually sometimes even worse. And I actually come across this one when I started to look into research into the Grail, which eventually led to my book Servants of the Grail. And what I came up with was how the stories of the Grail begin to appear in the 12th century. And then in the early 13th century, you have a German, Wolfram von Eschenbach, who is qualified and classified by every Grail historian as an anomaly. They don't know what to do with him, and they just put him in a category of his own. Now, Wolfram is a very interesting guy, because when he starts to write about the Grail, Wolfram specifically says, everybody before me has got it wrong, and I will put the record straight. By the way, I'm going to talk about facts. I am a guy who's not going to write about fiction. I am a guy who's going to talk about facts, i.e. a historian. What do historians today say in posh books? Wolfram wrote a literary invention. He invented all of these things. So they just disregard specifically what Wolfram has said. They do not even look at what Wolfram is saying. They just say, oh, this is just a literary device which he was using. Well, when you dig one layer deeper, you will find that Wolfram in his entire life does not write a single piece of fiction. Everything he writes throughout his entire career are family biographies. Now, what does Wolfram say when he writes about the Grail? He says that somebody has given him a family account, and he is pretty much asked to write this down into his own vernacular, i.e. German. And that's what he does. He doesn't do more, he doesn't do less. The only thing he does is relate a family history as he has heard it from a source. And it's a story about a family who have this precious, bizarre object, which is the Grail, and which, in his opinion, of all the documentation which he has found, is a stone. What do present historians do with this? They say it's all made up. It's fiction, rather. Wolfram is a guy who wrote a literary invention. And that just makes the blood boil when historians just come up with these glib, bland statements which are complete distortions of the information which is actually written down and which they fail to mention or even discuss or even tackle in their books. It would be something if they were actually tackling them in their books. But no, they just pretend, just like Anthony Frazier with Oliver Cromwell, that Drogheda never happened, that Wulfram never said any of these things. Now, with the subject of the Grail, we're very close to Mary Magdalene, and Mary Magdalene, you've already touched upon her, but there is so much more to her than just a woman who was venerated in the south of France. She is a very controversial woman for the church as well.
Well, we could do, you know, 100 shows on Mary Magdalene, and I could still only scratch the surface of how important she was, and certainly what has been written about her and what she means to me personally. In terms of what we're talking about historically, you know, one of the things I want to say is this. I actually just got an email from a dear friend of mine this week saying, asking me for talking points because he had mentioned the idea of Mary Magdalene being married to Jesus and this very controversial concept. And apparently when he mentioned it at this dinner party he was at, he was completely attacked by people who told him that this was an unacceptable idea. And the argument that all of them use, and certainly an argument I've heard hundreds of times, if not thousands, is, well, it doesn't say so in the Bible. And if it doesn't say so in the Bible, then it can't be true. Now, this is not a biblical discussion, but I want to make a point about history here. The Bible accounts were not meant to be complete biographies of anything or anybody. You know, depending on what version you're looking at and what the font size is, the Gospel of John is 15 pages long. I don't know about you, but I don't think you can write a complete biography of arguably the most important man in history in 15 pages. The gospel accounts were the good news. They were supposed to be, and this is my perspective, but I believe that these accounts were meant to be essentially lecture notes. These are the notes on what Jesus said. This is what he said. This is what he taught us. Here are some examples from his life that we learn from. These were not meant to be complete biographies of anything. They were snapshots of what Jesus was teaching us and what was important at the time. And remember, people who are writing these accounts are people who are familiar with what's happening in the first century. They might not have felt it was necessary to give elaborate details of Jesus's personal life. Or another point of view could be that they intentionally did not include Jesus's personal life because it was controversial or because they were trying to protect something. There are a lot of things we don't know about the gospel accounts. And as you know, most people know, there's been a lot of editing, there's been a lot of massaging, there are still a lot of questions about who wrote them. We don't even know who definitively wrote the Gospels. I mean, this is one of the things that I get into with people often, is that what we do know is that, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't write them. These are later attributions. But the point is that we get so fixated on what we think we know is history. And I absolutely love it. It's my favorite thing in the world when a biblical historian says, well, we know this. We know nothing. We know nothing. We draw what we hope are educated conclusions based on the smattering of information that we have. So anyone who says they know definitively what happened in history is simply not telling the truth. We're all speculating, all of us. And I think that we have to remember. And my speculation, as long as I am doing my due diligence, is, I believe, no less meaningful than the speculation of someone who has a PhD after their name. In a lot of cases, those of us who are out there doing field research and spending a lot of time, I've spent 15 years on 4 continents trying to uncover every possible legend there is about Mary Magdalene in multiple languages. As you yourself know, you've helped me in Dutch, you've helped me in French. We have looked through so much information in so many different places. And I believe that I have actually done a lot more research than the average person with a doctor in front of their name.
And one of the conclusions we're reaching when we're kind of like looking the way history is presented, and this is a bit of a joke, but to underline the point, is that some civilizations also do not seem to have women. And it's definitely something which we're beginning to see in the Mayan civilization, where we believe there was not a single woman until roughly about the 15th or 16th century, because when you look at the way history is being presented of Mayan civilization, to some extent the Incan civilization, what you see on documentaries on television about these civilizations, it seems to be there were no women.
And this is something that we joke about all the time, but it's really not a joke. It's really, really very, very serious. And that is so many historical accounts do not include women. It's history, not her story. And as I am fond of saying, history begins with his, but heresy begins with her. You know, and we have been talking about this a lot because with 2012 coming up and everything that's going on with the Mayans, we've been doing so much Mayan research and watching documentaries about the Mayan, and there are no women. Women are never mentioned. Women are never interviewed. There apparently are no female voices out there in terms of 2012 or the Mayan civilization. And I am really anxious to find some. So if you are aware of anyone who is out there writing about Mayan women or the female perspective, please write to me through our website, thespiritrevolution.com, because I'm very interested in talking to those people. But, you know, I've also been fond of saying, both through Twitter and Facebook and to anyone who will listen, that apparently, according to the History Channel, there were no women in history either. And that brings us to the subject that I have been on a real tear about these last couple of weeks, and that is this whole notion of the, quote, History Channel. This is a two-part tirade. So here's part one. You know, I was watching the History Channel last weekend, and there on the History Channel was someone basically presenting my perspective on certain esoteric subjects on a History Channel special. And this man was very clearly quoting from my books and quoting from my work. And of course, certainly not attributing any of that to me. Now, this doesn't bother me so much. You know, I'm an internationally published author. My work is in 50 countries. I am excited when people talk about it, and I am happy that people are saying these series are out there. All of that's fine. That's not the point. The point is, it was a man on a show produced by men with pretty much all male talking heads. And my point of view is this. If you are going to use my theories about the divine feminine and where women were in history, why are you not asking me? Why am I not invited, or why aren't any women invited to be speaking about these theories? When I watch these History Channel specials with all the male talking heads, I sit there in front of the television and say, where are the women? So, first of all, the History Channel doesn't have any women on it. And secondly, the History Channel doesn't have any history on it. I have been really, really combing the programming for the History Channel, watching it very, very carefully for the last couple of weeks. And frankly, I'm disgusted. I'm outraged. I'm embarrassed. I'm sad that this dumbing down of America has happened in such a way that the History Channel no longer presents anything that even remotely resembles history. And so just for fun, I put together an excerpt from what their primetime programming was last night. Okay, this is primetime History Channel, their primetime schedule, 8 p.m., Pawn Stars, Pezzed Off, Corey and Chum meet an outspoken Pez collector looking to sell 50 pieces of classic Americana. Will Corey check out some serious cash for these collectibles, or we get his sugar fix somewhere else? Oh, wait, it gets bigger. 8:30 p.m., more Pawn Stars! Because pawn shops are the greatest piece of American history, aren't they? Rick has an opportunity to buy a 1948 portable electric shock therapy machine. Okay, so I guess it's maybe a shock therapy machine from 1948 is history, if you want to make that stretch. Wait, here's my favorite. My favorite. Oh, wait, 10 p.m., Pawn Stars. Corey and Chum meet a dumpster diver with a life-size Power Ranger. Will Corey use his superhero powers to conjure up some cash, or will the dark forces compel him to cast the Ranger out? Okay, I'm not making this stuff up. This isn't satire. This is the prime time lineup for the History Channel. It is full of Pawn Stars and American Garbage Pickers, Axemen, Stories of Loggers, and Ice Truckers. Now look, all that stuff is, you know, fine. I don't have any issues with the programming. If you find that entertaining, that's great. But is it history? You know, put that stuff on the Discovery Channel, put it on the All Testosterone Channel, put it on something, but it's not history! Where is the history in the History Channel? So as I continue to search for history and for something with any kind of substance, I then move to History International, which is their sister station. And whereas this is slightly more substantial, there's some ancient mysteries, there's a few things on here that aren't about World War II, but not many, I find in the course of 7 days of looking at the History Channel, two, this is 24 hours of programming for 7 days, two shows that speak of women. One of them is The Naked Archaeologist, and God bless Simca, because he does something about Helena being the first archaeologist. So I want to praise him for that. But the rest of the programming is entirely devoid of women, except for one show, which is on tonight, about sex in the Wild West. And the synopsis talks about shady ladies and how prostitutes and prostitution represents the first female presence in the Wild West. Really? Is this the best we can do, History Channel? No history on the History Channel and no women anywhere? And when you do have women, it's only the prostitutes in the Old West? I mean, am I the only one who is outraged about this? Am I the only one who wants to see their charter revoked? They own the domain name history.com. And frankly, I think if you're going to claim to be the media center for history, you need to stand for something. So I challenge you, History Channel, to start creating some programming or buying some programming that actually matters and that is actually history. And if you're having trouble finding anything, you can reach me through the website. I'm happy to give you some.
And it's just one of so many things which is going on, because the History Channel, as you say, oh, the domain name history.com, they are supposed to be the voice of history, at least on television. It's really the windmill which needs to be torn down, or at least changed into something which is representative of what history is. And I have got a track record, just like yourself, into being ruffling a few feathers is probably a correct term of some people. And for those people who are buying Nexus or can buy Nexus, the current issue, the February-March issue of Nexus and in Australia, New Zealand, England, is carrying my article about ClimateGate, and the March-April issue of Nexus US will be carrying that article as well. Now, ClimateGate is one of these things which shows you how corrupt science has become. ClimateGate happened a few months ago in the run-up to the Copenhagen summit on global warming, which got every head of state, including Barack Obama, Gordon Brown, and all of these people together. And the matter of discussion was this: how to work out a scenario for the future. Now, as you will see from the coverage which it got, it was a bit of a disaster, with Obama trying to actually bully several nations or trying to do certain initiatives on his own without the support of other nations, just to pretend that actually what was the conclusion of the summit was something which he had been trying to get established anyway. But the ClimateGate story is actually about scientists who we all think are really nice people in somehow fringe little air-conditioned offices, this time not in North Carolina, but somewhere in Oxford and somewhere else in America. And what these people had been doing was actually exposed by a person hacking into their computers. Now, that's not a very nice thing to do, but whoever did that, and it's actually not known who the person was who did it, but when all of that information was published on the internet, what they found was that the ClimateGate scenario was this. These scientists for years have been creating false statistics, have been creating false material to argue that man has contributed to global warming. Now, this is irrelevant of the fact or the possibility that man has contributed to global warming. It's got nothing to do with that. What these scientists just did was short-circuit this possibility and just invent material and change certain parameters rather of statistical formula so that it made the conclusion obvious. Our taxes, Al Gore has created a career over the past few years saying this is a fact, and it's a simple fact, alas, that this is all one gigantic lie. And this is something which is so at the heart of this problem, because we are confronted here in the realm of vice presidents and heads of state who are trying to spend money on things which is actually based on false science, of things which has, you know, should not be happening. But this is how far the problem has got. And it's one windmill there. There are so many windmills which are out there which need to be torn down. History is being rewritten, science is being rewritten on a constant basis, and we are presented with a false sense of identity of who we are and what the real problems in this world are. Now, if there is a challenge there for a spirit revolution, I think that's definitely one of them. And I know of many people who are vociferous, and some of them who are not vociferous at all, but very much working on trying to change this paradigm. And we've had some of these people on already. We have had Andy Collins, who has been battling the windmill that is Zahi Hawass. And we have so many people out there who are trying to change this paradigm and are trying to do something about this. But really, it's also down to us to kind of say, actually, Porn Stars, or whatever the program is called, it's not that interesting. I don't think, what was it, Pest Dispensers and
Power Rangers,
how many people are actually interested in watching a 10 p.m. show on the History Channel?
Well, what I'm told when I challenge these paradigms is that the History Channel is a male-driven demographic, that this is what is selling, this is what people are watching, and as a result, that it's all about ratings. They're going to continue on this path because it currently works. I suppose what I would like to challenge is, can we try something else? I mean, this is what people are being given, and it's what people are watching, because there is nothing else to watch. You know, I don't understand why we can't raise our expectations a little bit higher. You know, is it strictly the realm of PBS to do intelligent programming on history? Maybe it is. But then maybe PBS should own the domain name history.com. Again, I go back to saying, if you are going to call yourself the voice of history in the Western world, then you need to stand for something.
And as you're pointing out, it's the dumbing down effect as well. It's making everything reality based. It's making everything a game, because this game format is believed to sell. And it's also cheap programming. It's where there are huge profits margin on doing something. As you say, you've spent 15 years dashing around countries. If we both were adding our invoices or our bills of hotel costs and flights and car rental and all of these things together, you come up with a huge sum of money of what we have invested in visiting these places. And the same thing applies for all of these documentaries. It's so much easier to go to wherever the Power Ranger is, somewhere in the middle of America.
In a dumpster,
where you probably do not have to charge entrance fees to kind of like, you know, get a film crew in. But when you go to places like San Juan de la Peña or Chartres or all of these places, it takes a lot of effort, it takes a lot of organization. Oh my God, it's actually hard work, but it actually pays off because you've got beautiful images and it's something people would want to see. But it's obviously something which also costs a lot of money and which is somewhat harder to produce. And what we see so much is sloppy writing, sloppy editing, sloppy presenting, and hence an uninteresting program. But hey, It does the job because History Channel has got 24 hours of programming to fill, and that's precisely what these programs seem to be designed to do, to fill as easily as possible, as quickly as possible, and as cheaply as possible a program.
Well, at the risk of, you know, alienating the History Channel further, and the production companies who are creating these shows, like this Nostradamus series, for example, that has me in a little bit of a tirade, they're lazy. Okay, this is lazy production. There are the same talking heads year in and year out who talk about Nostradamus, who talk about these prophecies. It is the exact same people saying the exact same thing. Really, how much more time and effort and money are we going to invest? And the only time they say something different now is when they're quoting me or somebody else who is not given the forum to go on and speak, dare I say it, because I'm female, or maybe because it's just too much work for the History Channel producers to go to my website and say, would you like to come on and discuss this? I think it's just easier for them. Call the usual suspects, round them up, let them say the same things, edit it in with yet more footage of the Twin Towers, yet more footage of people screaming, death, destruction, the apocalypse is coming. It's so frustrating for me that there is such an incredible opportunity to do some really exciting episodes on some of this research that real people are doing. And none of it's happening. And all it would take is one truly inspired producer, just one really inspired producer who wants to do something of quality, of interest, of excitement, and not the same old crap. And I don't know where that producer is, but if you are out there, I challenge you to stand for something and create some programming that really matters.
And just going back to the team of the Da Vinci Code and where Mary Magdalene first did get some outing on television, like yourself, I saw lots of my friends and colleagues being interviewed ad nauseum, being asked the same questions all over again, and by default giving the same answers, because what else can you do? And there was this interesting effect that when you started adding it all up, you found that, say, the History Channel, Discovery Channel, and all of these channels together had commissioned 5, 6, 7 shows on the Da Vinci Code. And because everybody was following exactly the same pattern, what you ended up was 7 identical shows, which by after show 3 being aired was causing a lot of problems for these production companies, because obviously they felt that somehow, somewhere, they had to come up with something new. But this was physically impossible because they had always been focusing on exactly the same thing. And it was also interesting the way Mary Magdalene was actually treated, because all the focus was on, is she or is she not married to Jesus? As if that is the most important thing about what Mary Magdalene stood for. It is completely bypassing the real content, as into kind of like, what did she stand for? Mm-hmm. What perspective might she have that, for example, Peter did not have?
Well, the other piece about that is, you know, and I have said this before, and I take some responsibility for the Magdalene monster in that I wrote a book about Mary Magdalene being married to Jesus as well. But the point is not so much that she was married to Jesus. The point is that she is his spiritual successor. The point is that she takes Christianity to Western Europe and establishes churches and missions and becomes a great teacher and a great preacher in her own right, separate from what is happening in Rome. Mary Magdalene as spiritual leader is what really matters here and is what is really a threat to the church. I don't think the initial threat to the church was Mary Magdalene as Jesus' wife. I think the threat to the church was Mary Magdalene as spiritual leader, separate from the politics and the economics of what Rome was becoming. And in terms of history, the piece about Mary Magdalene that I think is ultimately important that everyone missed and not one person ever discussed in any of these documentaries is whatever you believe doesn't matter historically. What matters is this. We know that hundreds of thousands of people did believe this and were killed for believing it. And we know that because the Inquisition records tell us that. The Inquisition records from the Albigensian Crusades say that the heretics were massacred, were burned en masse at the stake, were wiped out in the massacres of places like Béziers. People were hacked to pieces for believing that Mary Magdalene was married to Jesus and for believing in the heresies of Mary Magdalene. And that, for me, is critical. If millions of people arguably were going to die for this heresy, there had to have been a reason for it. And why aren't we focusing on that? Why aren't we looking at those elements? Genocide was committed against an entire culture of people for believing these things. So whatever you choose to believe in the 21st century about Mary Magdalene and Jesus is entirely up to you. But the fact is, history plays out that there has been acts of genocide committed against people who believed these very things. That's something that deserves a documentary. That's something that deserves a space on the History Channel.
And it definitely has had a space on the Spirit Revolution today, and it's a subject which we'll definitely come back to later. But for now, it's Philip Coppens and Kathleen McGowan. Our website is thespiritrevolution.com. Go and visit it. You will also be able to listen to some of our previous shows there. And until next week.
Until next week, why don't you write to the History Channel and tell them to put on some better programming. We'll see you then.